Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
FM, Los Angeles.
102.3 FM, Riverside.
And
105.0 AM,
Palm Springs. Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. And on the other side of the country, we've got Mr. Michael Holly.
Hello, Al.
Yeah, we're back. We're back after the long break.
Yes. Wow.
First show, and you're sitting on the first show. I'm surprised you.
I tried to work it. Yeah, you betcha. But that's right. I'll be flying your way out west for filming, so that'll be fun.
Yeah, you're going to be in that new. What's that?
History's Greatest Mysteries. Let's say Lawrence Fishburne. He's the one that narrates it. So they wanted to talk Jack the Ripper. So I said, okay, I will talk Jack the Ripper.
Well, yeah, you're the man to do it, especially with all the others they have listed on there, you know, anyway. But it's not about us today. Today we are back, and it's about the writers we bring on, and we're starting out with a bang this year. So talk about for Toronto, we've got a writer from back east in Canada, eh? And so we've got Miss Judy Penn-Shelleck. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Judy, where did it all start for you?
Where did it all start for you?
Yeah. Journalist, a magazine editor, you've got some best-selling books out, you've got a couple of crime series. You've got all of this, life in writing. Was that something you brought with you right from being a child? Were you that way in school and you just carried it on, or is this something that came along later?
Yeah, so I mean, I've always been an avid reader. I mean, my mom read to me when I was, forever. And so I always loved to read, and I always used to make up stories in my head, so I had a bit of a walk to school, and with no shoes in the snow. No.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would, make up sort of a story in my head, and then if it wasn't finished by the time I got to school, then I would just pick it up on the way home, the same story. Sometimes it'd take me a day to have it in my head, and sometimes take a couple of days or whatever. So I just thought everyone did that, right? I didn't think that was anything strange. And then I wanted to go to actually Ryerson for journalism, but my mother just didn't think that journalism was a proper job for a woman. And so I took business instead and went into the corporate world and became a credit manager, on and on. And then I guess I was in my mid-30s. I was commuting to Toronto from Holland Landing, which is a small town. And, the drives were long, and I'd be making up these stories in my head to kind of keep me, sane. And so one day I came home and I said to my husband, who was an engineer, you know what, I think I might start writing down these stories in my head. And, you know, he's like, you write stories in your head? I go, yeah, I don't even. He goes, no. I'm an engineer. Are you crazy? And so anyway, I didn't really do anything with it. And then I guess probably about 5 years later, my husband, for my birthday, bought me this creative writing workshop taught by Barry Dempster, who's a I think he's been up for the GG a couple times for poetry and that sort of thing. And anyway, I started writing my stories down and got a couple published in like literary magazines, and then took some courses and started writing for magazines, and the magazines then hired me as their editor, and it just kind of spun off, right? And just kind of, so I gave up that whole corporate credit manager thing, which I hated. In 2003. Yeah, so 2003, I haven't actually had a real job since 2003.
But you have your passion now.
I do. I mean, and it, honestly, when I broke into print, into media in 2003, print was still really vibrant, you know? So it was really easy to get into different magazines, and I have quite a knowledge of antiques, and so antiques were still quite popular at that time. And so it was easy to break in. Today it would not be, because there's just so many, there's hardly any print media left, you know. So then it would be a very different story to try to do it today. But I was lucky and broke in. And I guess it was around 2012, I went to a conference in Toronto called Bloody Words. And I went as a fan. You know, I'm a huge fan of crime fiction and nonfiction. And I was really excited to meet, you know, Howard Schreier and Giles Blunt and Linwood Barclay's people. So anyway, so I went there, and when I was going to the panels, I thought, you know, I could do this. I mean, how hard could it be? So anyway, I came home and I'm very, very inspired and started, writing and started writing my first book. And yeah, 24, I guess it took me a couple of years to write that first one. Lots of false starts, didn't really have a clue what I was doing. And but eventually finished it and got it. A published small press publisher in the United States picked it up. And yeah, so that's kind of sort of went from there. Yeah.
Yeah. I find that interesting because when you're in a career in the real world, as they say, and doing a job like that, like you were doing, to give that up and to actually try and publish something you've written, that takes a lot of courage, I would think. Don't you think?
Well, I mean, I should add to the story that the company that I was working for at the time, they were doing a huge sort of reorg, right? Mm. And so my boss had sort of said, you know, we could do this with you or that with you. And I was just I'm sort of done. Like, there's nothing really more depressing than collecting money for a living, quite frankly. So I said, you know, don't do that. I will be happy to train, you know, all these different people on my job. Just, you know, give me a decent severance package and let me right off to the sunset. And they did that. They were great. So that severance package combined with some unemployment insurance really kind of funded my first year and a half, I guess, of freelance journalism. But I was quickly earning close to what I made in the corporate world, because I was writing for like 7 different magazines at a time. It was crazy. But yeah, I think something I really wanted to do and something I really love. And I developed a really good reputation pretty quickly. So I think that is all made a difference. Ironically, I thought, you know, having all this journalistic background, being the editor of, New England Antiques Journal, all this stuff, that my protagonist in my first book is an antique shop owner. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I'm going to get all these offers and it's going, all this is going to matter, but it doesn't. It didn't matter. I got like a zillion rejections before I got an acceptance. Of course, I started, you know, really high with like the top New York agent or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Of course, of course.
Which, yeah, they didn't return my call. I don't understand. Anyway.
That was rude. Yeah, who was it? I'll call them right now. I'll call them live.
Yeah, would you mind? I know. It's like when Skeletons in the Attic, that's my best-selling book. So that came out in 2016, and it reached number 1 on Amazon. It was very exciting. And like Michael Connelly was number two. That's when my husband, I think, finally realized, oh, maybe there's something to this author thing.
That's
know?
Right.
But, you know, Michael never called. He never, I don't get that. Like, what's up with that?
You want a cell number? I'll give it to you.
Yeah. There you go.
I'm a big fan. I've read everything. You know, I love, I'm a huge fan of his. So.
I've heard that. Just like Stephen King. I've heard he's all right. But
yes, Stephen. He's a good buddy of mine, yeah.
He's just had a
Judy, we're too much of nonfiction, true crime stuff, so that there's so much to that.
There is.
Yeah.
I'm actually fascinated by the whole true crime thing. I mean, I love research. I mean, that comes from a journalistic background. Like, research is really, I enjoy doing it. I actually can spend, you know, the better part of the day researching, you know, what the moon phase was on a certain day or whatever. And, you know.
So what you're trying to say is my next book is actually Jack the Ripper in Canada, because the guy Tumbledy was actually, he lived in Toronto and he had like 3,000 acres in Guelph. So
really?
You're trying to tell me that you're going to help me research this? I love this. Thank you, Judy.
Yeah, but, you know, I've often thought, you know, I mean, I'd love to know, you know, how you stumble upon that sort of thing. You know, like, I mean, I was... That to me is fascinating, right? I'd love to do the research on something like that. I don't even know where I'd start.
And I'll start with newspapers.com. But yeah. What happens is you have to know what you're targeting, and then and then know the time frame, and then so then it kind of just builds. And then you the coolest thing is discovery. You know, it's something that you know that nobody else knows about, and then you just keep on going. Yeah. So, but Toronto is just a wealth of information on this guy. So it's really cool. And you're right there.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
No, it's great.
I know. I mean, I think the whole truth, because I do, in my Marketville series, I have the two series. The Glass Dolphin is very cozy, the antique shop owner. It's sort of like, you know, Murder, She Wrote kind of vibe. But the Marketville series, they're what I call cold case cozies, right? And so the last book, A Fool's Journey, it's about a young man that was missing like 20 years before, and now the family still hasn't heard from him, so my protagonist gets in the act and starts digging around, right? But that case was based on the case of a young man that I read about in my local paper that had been missing for 20 years. And I found missingadults.ca, and I... because his photograph was credited to missingadults.ca. So I went there, and then I went onto that website, and then I found his little blurb and some age-progressed photos and that sort of thing. And then I contacted the founder, Lisa Dion, and said, you know, what can you tell me? I don't want to use this guy specifically, but I want to sort of build a story around it. And so she was terrific, because she really, you know, I didn't want to, the last thing I wanted to do was write a fictional story and then kind of people that have actually been in that situation that didn't feel real to them, if you know what I mean. Like, that seemed important to me.
Okay.
Lisa, she actually becomes Lucy Daniluk in the book. She helped me a lot. And I did fictionalize the character quite a lot, which is a good thing because, and here's almost a creepy thing. And I won't give you the guy's name because it's, you know, sort of a secret. But the book was released on August 21st, 2019, and on that day, the young man that I based the story on returned home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, creepy, eh? Yeah.
Let him out of the basement. That's what happened.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems so bizarre to me, and I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened to him, because Lisa phoned me, and she said, you're never going to believe it. The family called and said, take the listing down. He's home. But we don't know where he was. We know nothing, right? So I'm very glad that I fictionalized a lot of it, because, you know, if I didn't, and then he was, yeah. Anyway,
yeah. No, so, it's tough. Yes,
I do love research, yeah. And that's one of the, you know, it goes to show that one little article in the paper and how it sort of led me through this whole process of digging and researching, and I enjoy doing it a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing, you know, when you're doing true crime, there's so much when you're going through the papers every single day through the paper and every single page, because especially if you're looking at the 20s or 30s or something, right, a long time ago, the way they wrote articles was so much different. But it's so interesting. But that's great, because if you didn't do research, I think a crime fiction or historical fiction book would be less, right? Because it doesn't read true then, right?
I check every fact. I had a little, in my cozy series, a hole in one, there's a murder on a golf course. The guy that gets sort of arrested is an antiques, the ex-husband of the antique shop protagonist. And so I thought he needs to have like an antique gun, I think, because he's antique. So, but I don't know anything about guns. So then I called the York Region Police Department and spoke to Constable Pattenden, who does their media, and sort of asked him, what are the rules about antique guns? And what do they have to do? And he was helpful, but then he also said, contact this Sean, I can't remember his last name, but Sean at oldguns.ca. So I contacted Sean, and Sean was like, he needs this type of revolver because that would have been something that RCMP would have used in such and such a year, and blah, blah, blah. And
perfect.
So it was perfect. Now, the thing is, all that, talking to Andy Pattenden, talking to Sean at oldguns.ca, doing the research on the gun and all of that, it may be boiled down to one paragraph in the book, at the end of the day. It wasn't a big part of it. But if I had gotten that detail wrong, somebody out there knows about antique guns that would have said, you know what, she just does know what she's talking about. And then the whole book would be read for them, right?
Well, Well, and it ruins it for me, actually, in a sense. More in series I see on streaming TV, like Prime or Netflix, when I see some sort of show that it's dated and supposed to be happening in the 30s or wherever, and they're speaking like it's 2010. It just throws me. I kind of go, oh, that's stupid. I get so focused on what they're doing that way, I lose interest in the story. So I think it's important.
It is, and it's funny you say that because I was talking to, I saw a webinar with Iona Wishaw, who's a BC author, and she talked about this thing called engrams, N-G-A-R-A-M-S, which I'd never heard of. But what it is it's a search engine, and you put in something like can't get my head around it, for instance, as an example of a saying that people say today all the time, right? And it'll tell you when that saying became popular. So that's really helpful if you're writing, trying to capture dialogue from like the 50s or the 60s or something.
Right.
Nobody said can't get your head around it then. So you're absolutely right. If I was to read a book set in the 60s and I read that, I'd think that doesn't seem right to me. Like nobody said that then. So so this engrams, it's quite wonderful. You should check it out.
Yeah. No,
it's great.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating. But it's so important to make the story real. And that brings me to your character. So you might think of this as a weird question, but I've talked to so many fiction writers and they give me different answers for this. So I think it's an important question. Where do your characters come from and what do you think of your characters? I mean this in a sense of, some writers will say, well, they're like my children. They're like my family and stuff. How is it for you?
Well, they're definitely not my kids or my family, but they do live in my head and sometimes quite annoyingly. So my favorite, in the Glass Dolphin series, I have Arabella Carpenter, who's the antique shop owner around, 40, likes cookies, and feisty, has an on-again relationship with her ex-husband, Levon Larroquette, who is, in my head, looks like Kris Kristofferson did in A Star is Born. That is a much better make, by the way, than the most recent Star is Born, which is not that good.
Right,
but anyway, that's nothing against Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, who I think are great, but it's just not as good a movie, in my opinion. But anyway, so that's what he looks like. So it's quite fun writing about him, because, Kris was quite attractive in his time. And still is, I'm sure. Anyway, so that's them. And then Emily Garland is a journalist and a runner. And I, of course, was a journalist and I have run marathons. And she's 35 and I used to be. So, it's all good. there, right? So they're kind of like fun characters, you know, that I just, like, I was named after Judy Garland, so Garland for Emily Garland. Emily, my favorite book growing up was Emily Climbs by Ellen Montgomery, a story about a young woman who wants to be a journalist when she grows up. And so, you know, probably the inspiration for me wanting to do that as well. So, you know, those are characters I like them. Arabella, I really like. I like her so much that I actually have her as a minor character in the Marketville series. I always find, a, you know, some antique that Calamity has to contact her about, right? So, so Marketville, I have Calamity Barnstable, also known as Callie. And I love her. I mean, she's just, I think in a lot of ways, she's me. But younger, but she's definitely got, you know, like she's been dumped on Valentine's Day when she was expecting an engagement ring, that kind of thing. All these things have happened to me at some point, right? So I just pulled the brain in, you know, and I figure, you know, maybe, you know, the guy that dumped me, it was actually high school that I got dumped and it was a, you know, a promise ring I was expecting, but I've just amped the story up a little bit. But I just think, you know, I hope that guy sees me and says, I should have stayed with her instead of, you know, Betty Ann.
Well, do you take that person to use that character, that person that did something bad to you and,
absolutely,
and hurt them?
There's there's no better way of getting even
there
with
you
somebody
go.
than writing them into a story. And actually, I did write a short story. It's called Live Free or Die. And it takes place of a young 23-year-old girl in Toronto that ends up having a relationship with her boss, who's 10 years her senior. And let's just say that particular relationship, that boss that I had when I was 23, that guy still may be alive, but not in my story. So I got even with him a whole lot of years later, right? So
anyway. Make it torturous too, right? It has to be.
Absolutely.
It's a long, drawn out one. It's not like a quick old.
There goes your true crime, Al. There goes your true crime.
Yeah. No, I just say because J.D. Horn. That's when he said that. He said that he's so sensitive that when he's in a grocery store, that if someone cuts him off, he'll take that person's character and hurt them in one of his books.
I actually have done that, not actually hurt them, but in one of the Glass Dolphin series, I've got Emily going to, the dollar store, and she's got a cold, and she's feeling sorry for herself, and she's got cough drops, and Kleenex, all the stuff in her hand, and she's in this big lineup, and this another cashier opens up and says, I can take the next person in line, and last guy in the line runs up, and Emily sort of says, well, you were the last guy, you're supposed to be waiting in line, and the guy sort of, you know, gives her a hard time, and that happened to me in a dollar store, and the guy was just horrible, and I thought, I wrote this whole scene. It's like, you know, okay, so the guy was just awful, right? He was like, you know, you snooze, you lose, lady. And I was like, what is
my.
There? I've been waiting for like 10 minutes, right? So anyway, I was quite, I ended up turning it into a scene in the book. So really everything that happens to me eventually ends up in some sort of a chapter somewhere.
Therapeutic, though.
Yeah. You're working it out in front of everyone.
Yeah.
Well, but it's funny, but it's not. It's just, since you put a lot of yourself into it, but I guess a lot of writers do, does it ever worry you, or does it ever make you feel a little bit self-conscious to write things that are very personal to you and to let anybody in the world read them and review them?
Yeah, so I'm not sure that I write, like, I mean, these little snippets of things that have happened to me, I always obviously exaggerate the details, and so I don't really feel that people are getting to know me that well personally, do you know what I mean? And I'm pretty careful on my social stuff not to include, you know, pictures of my house or anything. I'll show pictures of the water, and we have a cottage, and I show pictures of the water, but never the actual property or whatever, right? So I'm really careful about that stuff. I don't know. I don't know if I've actually answered your question.
No, I find it interesting because some people, have difficulty with that. When they read a review that picks out a certain detail in the story, and that detail is a real detail to the person that wrote it. It's something very important to them, and they've wrote it into the story, into one of the characters, you know, for whatever reason. And then all of a sudden someone criticizes that detail by saying it's stupid or whatever. You know, they kind of, you know, a person would never act that way. That's stupid, you know, people are. And then all of a sudden they're like, oh, but that did happen to me, you know. And
well, you know what they say. I mean, you know, truth is stranger than fiction.
Well, certainly.
Right? I mean, a lot of sometimes things that happen, you can't write about them because nobody would ever believe it would ever happen, right? But I would say that, like, as far as reviews go, I do read. Like, I review books on Goodreads. I read every review that people post on Goodreads, the good and the bad, right? And I, you know, because you can learn from all of them. And I, even the awful ones, I still appreciate that the person took the time to read my book. And if they didn't like it, okay. I mean, I've read, you know, best-selling novels that I haven't particularly cared for. You know, they've been critically, you know, lauded, and I've been sort of like, eh, you know. So it's okay. I don't take it too personally. The one story I love to tell is, I don't think he's with us anymore because he stopped reviewing altogether. But his name was Phil, and he would only ever give me a one-star review, one star every time. You know, I don't know what all the hype was about. You know, I didn't get this book at all, whatever, and one star. But then he'd buy the next book. Like, he don't like some book. Why are you buying them? But he did. And then I think my biggest site was one time he gave me 2.5 stars, but I was like, oh my gosh, that's like getting like 10 stars from anybody else, right? Because Phil really, I always seem to disappoint him, but he kept buying my books, so I don't know why. So I miss him. He doesn't.
I hunted him down and had him killed. Don't worry. I can only take so much negative, and I have to go after them, you know.
But sometimes people are cruel. Like, I mean, one that really rankled was a lady that, like, it was funny because that day had two reviews. One was 5-star, couldn't put the book down, loved it. And the other one was, I thought my grade 5, you know, kindergartner wrote this. I was like, what? Come on. But anyway, you know, it's fine. You can't, it's subjective. Reading is subjective, right?
Yeah.
So accept
that. It's really hard. It's hard because you can get one, like you said, I've had that where this man doesn't know how to write. He's terrible. He's like couldn't graduate high school with this. And then the next person gives you a 5-star and they're saying, this is amazing. And you're like, wow, you know, I just, brothers? I don't know. It's weird. So do you like to be involved with a lot of your readers and stuff like that? Do you kind of interact a lot online or do you stay away from that?
Well, I have the Facebook, you know, I have like lots of friends, so to speak, which, you know, I don't even know who they are. In that way, I do. I mean, I visit book clubs. I love that. I mean, my local book clubs, I've visited some local book clubs. I've got a couple Zoom book club meetings.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I have fun doing that. I mean, it's not always, so usually it's great. I remember I did one in Tottenham, which is a small town not too far from where I live. And it was a senior's residence. And I thought, oh, that'll be nice. And so they all, you know, read the book, I guess, whichever title they had selected. And then I went to chat with them, and, you know, they had tea and cookies, and that was all really nice. But, you know, the one lady, you know, she wrote stories about her cat, so she thought they were better than my book. And then another lady started talking about Frank Mahovlich. I was like, I have no idea why, because, you know, okay, I mean, I know who he is, and he played hockey and all that, but, like, he hasn't played hockey. I don't even know if he's still alive.
Well, probably not.
And so, you know, but so it was clear that, you know, maybe they weren't all, you know, maybe they didn't really understand everything they read. So,
yeah. Right, right.
But anyway, it was still fun to have. And they were homemade cookies. So, you know, there was a positive there.
Yeah. Yeah. They probably put pot in the cookies or something. Right?
But, it, you know, I do like that. I really do.
Oh, you like the
enjoy
pot?
It.
Yeah.
I do enjoy meeting readers. I do. I mean, I love, that's why I liked going to conferences, because you could meet other authors, certainly, which is great for networking and just feeding off, getting ideas. But readers, you know, it's really fun. So I miss that. That's one thing I've really missed.
Would you consider yourself an extrovert then? I mean, I see here a lot of introverts that are authors, but an extrovert or?
No. And I think what I read somewhere, somebody described it as being an extroverted introvert. So I can be an extrovert, but I absolutely am happiest on my own, in my own little space. So, you know, that is, it's funny, but I can't, like, so for instance, if I go to a conference, people say, oh, you could save money by staying, you know, rooming with somebody. And I'm like, there, nothing horrifies me more than the thought of rooming with somebody, because after I spent like 3 hours being on, I just want to go into my room and, like, watch, you know, HGTV or, you know, something that, you know, the Cooking Network or something, and just not talking to anybody, right? I just want to be alone. So I, you know, I think really I am happiest alone. I'm an only child. I grew up, you know, in an environment where my parents didn't like to have people over or anything. They're very private people. So I grew up in that way. So, yeah. And my husband is the most introverted introvert you're ever going to meet in your life. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sound just like Mike.
I'm from 8 kids in my family, and I have 6 myself, 2 dogs, and lots of chaos. So it's controlled chaos.
It is chaos, yes. Well, I've always had a dog. I have a dog actually lying under my desk now, sleeping as we chat. So, yeah, I'm a big dog.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good thing. When you come up with these stories, Where does it happen for you? Like, how do you come up with a story? Like, when you're doing these series, like when you were talking about Marketville and stuff, where does that all come from for you? Are you just sitting there and it just like zooms in or something, or how does that happen?
Well, I have a lot of these, like what I call pretty notebooks, you know, just like notebooks. And so I always have like three or four on the go with different ideas that sort of come to me. But a lot of them just really, they come from life. So say the very first book, which is The Hangman's Noose, was living in Holland Landing at the time. And Holland Landing was founded by Samuel Lount, who was hanged for treason. And so I found, you know, when I first moved to Holland Landing, I saw this plaque dedicated to this guy hanged for treason. That fascinated me, so I had to read all about that. And anyways, it was a small town that was, you know, still close enough to Toronto that it was starting to get, you know, urban sprawl, for lack of a better word. And there was going to be one of the schools there was going to be deaccessioned and sold, and they were going to turn it into like townhomes or something. And I just thought, you know, wow, like, you know, people were really up in arms about it, you know, this whole thing. And I thought, well, what if, you know, what if it was a school being sold off, but not for townhomes? What it was going to be sold off for, say, a mega box store, and that mega box store would then threaten all the little local businesses, one of them being the antique shop. And what if somebody was willing to murder over that? So that's sort of how that idea all, you know, sort of, so really the germ of it was something that was happening. And then I just, you know, took it and ran with it. And Skeletons in the Attic, which is, again, I think I told you my best-selling book. My husband and I were in our lawyer's office. We were going to update our wills. And I was still shopping around for a publisher for The Hangman's Noose. And I didn't want to write book two of a book that maybe wouldn't sell. So I thought I'd want to start a new book, but I didn't really know what to write about. But then when I was sitting in this lawyer's office and our lawyer was late, he was delayed in court, I thought, well, what if I was here to inherit money? And what if that there were strings attached, and what kind of strings? And so I started, you know, scribbling all these books. I always had a notebook even in my purse, started scribbling down all the stuff. By the time the lawyer arrived, I basically had the first chapter written, and I knew exactly where the story was going to go. So, you know, everything sort of gets inspired by things, you know, past and present, the second book in the Marketville series. My mother passed away in September 2016, and I found some documents in her closet, you know, her passport to Canada, the ship she came over on, some stuff from that. And I started, you know, stuff she never talked about. And so I thought, oh, so I started digging, like, to Pier 21 and found out, you know, some immigration status stuff. And then checked old train station things. And anyway, and that developed, while I was digging into, you know, my mother's life, it became the story of Annalise Prix, who was murdered in 1956. So there you go. I just take an idea and then my imagination goes crazy.
That's great. That's great.
You just never know where you're going to end up. Are you the type of person that can just sit down, structure your day? So in a sense, let's say there's going to be nobody around from, you know, 10 to 2. You can just sit down and go, okay, I'm going to write 10 to 2 and sit down and write. Or do you have to be in a certain frame of mind?
Yeah, I vowed when I left the corporate world in 2003, I vowed I would never again work a structured day, because that was the one thing I hated more than anything else. I did well in the corporate world, and I, you know, reached the manager position and all this type of thing. But I hated that 9-to-5 thing. I mean, it was like, maybe today I feel, you know, sharper between 8 and 10 at night or whatever. You know what I mean? Why does it have to be 9-to-5? So I definitely don't structure my day that way. I do try to write every single day, even on the weekends, but at different times of the day. In the summer, I'm a passionate golfer, not very good, sadly, but passionate. And so, you know, golf will be a priority, and then I'll find a way to write after golf, you know. But I will first golf, and then I won't. And then I will write, unless the golf is in the afternoon, in which case I'll try to write in the morning. But Yeah, so I kind of write at all different times, and I have my office, which is, you know, away from everything and quiet, and I tend to write either in silence or to talk radio, never to music.
Hmm. That's interesting. I usually have it all going. The television,
really?
The radio, and my dogs and music and everything, yeah.
Oh, my God. I can't. No, for me, if it's not really quiet, like, I don't get people that can go to a coffee shop and write. Like, I totally could never do that.
Yeah, I don't think
I could
do that either. Yeah, that's, you know.
That's me, though. I'm like Al. I have everything going on, but I could also do it in a coffee shop. Now, that doesn't mean it's very good writing, though. I suck at that part. See what I'm saying? It's the editor that I choose.
Well, there you have it. You heard it here. Now, don't buy any of Mike's books. no, they're very, very good, actually. Now, I see now, you were talking about this earlier, Crime Writers of Canada. So now you are a part of that group, and you're the chair now, I guess. What do you want to tell people about groups like that and groups such as the Crime Writers of Canada?
So, I belong to a number of associations. So I belong to Sisters in Crime, the Toronto branch, the National branch, and the Guppies branch. Guppies was the Great Unpublished, so I joined there when I wasn't published. And many of the published authors stay on to mentor unpublished authors. So I belong to all three of those organizations, and I'm reasonably active in all of them. I belong to International Thriller Writers, Short Mystery Fiction Society, and obviously Crime Writers of Canada. So Crime Writers of Canada, I joined back in 2012 as an associate member, you know, aspiring author. And then when I became an author, became a professional author member in 2015, I guess. And then in 2017, they asked if I'd want to join the board as a regional rep for Toronto, Southwestern Ontario. And so I said, sure. And since then I went on to become director and vice chair. And now I've spent the last, year and a half as chair. So my term ends at the end of May this year, and then I'll become past chair. And trust me, when I said I would take on the position of chair, I did not expect to take it on when COVID hit.
So, oh, that's right.
It has been a challenge. But anyways, it's a great association. We have, you know, member benefits, discounts on entries to the awards, and discounts on various magazines, and we have webinars and meet and greets, and so lots of things. And you know, we do other things, like we have a presence at conferences and that kind of thing as well. So I think it's really worthwhile to belong to associations in general, and I think it's really important as a Canadian to support Canadian crime writing, whether that be fiction or nonfiction. And one way of doing that is to belong to an association like Crime Writers of Canada, right?
Mm.
I think it's really important that we support our own. You know, Canadians are so quick to, it's funny, you know, like we don't really toot our own horn or anything, but then suddenly, you know, so-and-so's in California and Hollywood, and it's like, oh, they're Canadian, you know.
Yeah.
So, but when they were living in, you know, Winnipeg, nobody cared about
them. Yeah, that's very true. You know, William Shatner, he was Canadian.
Yeah, he's Canadian. Yeah. Like, that's true. Like, we don't, you know, it's the first thing you hear. Like, when you hear about an actor, it'll be, well, Ryan Reynolds, you know, he's Canadian. Like, you always hear, they're Canadian. Like, that's, people are, it's almost like we're not good enough unless we make it somewhere else, you know?
Yeah. That's very true. So, that's a very true feeling I think a lot of people have, you know, which... It's not legitimate, but it's true.
No, yeah. It's true.
So where do you see yourself going now? What's going to happen to Judy over the next few years?
Well, I'm waiting for Reese Witherspoon to pick one of my books for her book club.
That's
that
good.
Would be really nice. Hello, Reese, are you listening?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Call me.
There you go.
So, yeah, so I would really, I would like to, obviously I'm writing fourth book, Market Bell, right now. I have a standalone suspense that I'm probably around 30,000 words in, and kind of trying to figure out where I'm going to take it. It's such a pantser, like I don't plot at all. So That works in the more cozy mystery world. I'm finding with the standalone suspense, maybe I should be doing a little bit more outlining. So we'll see. Again, it's my first one, so I don't, you know where that's going to go. I'd like to take a course in screenwriting or playwriting just because I think it would be interesting and probably help my writing in general, not because I think I necessarily have any success at getting those plays or screenplays produced. And I probably wouldn't mind trying my hand at a nonfiction. So, you know, I've got lots of ideas. I've got more ideas than time.
Nonfiction? You mean Jack Ripper in Toronto would be a nice nonfiction? One of the things about screenwriting, though, is I had to do a screen that is I'm used to writing in past tense, and you have to do it in present tense. So it was really screwing with me all the way through.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, I mean, just the whole thing is that you're now, it's all basically, it's a dialogue driven, right? So,
yeah, right.
But I'm good at dialogue. Dialogue is one of my strengths, absolutely. So I think it would be good. And from what I understand from people that have done it, that they say that it really does help you with your writing, because you have to really have, the outline there or whatever. So I would like to take a course or something in it. It's just defining which course would be the best one to take and finding the time to take it.
Really. Yeah, it's a tough one. Eric Shapiro was one of our part-time hosts out of California, is writing a Netflix movie right now, and he's done quite a few movies and different shows. Oh. And he does it very well. He writes for a newspaper, and he's such a good writer. I'm amazed at how well he can just put things together. And I think you're right. I think doing the screenwriting like that, I think there's a big benefit to your overall ability from getting what you get out of it, you know. I think it's great.
I think, when I think back to my first book, like I said, it took me probably 2 years to write it. And now, I can pretty much get my first draft done in 3 to 4 months. And it's pretty clean, because I'm an editor. That's where my background is, right? So I sort of edit as I go. I mean, obviously, I have professional editor and all this type of thing. But the first draft is pretty clean, that comes from practice and learning and knowing what doesn't work for you, right? So I think the more different areas I try to branch out into, whether that's playwriting or screenwriting or whatever, can only help, even if it leads nowhere beyond just personal enrichment.
Mm. One thing you mentioned about how you just kind of do it as you go. How does that work when you do a series? Like when you're doing a series that has 3 or 4 books to it and maybe even more. So you don't have that outlined? You don't have it kind of where you want to be at the end of 4 books and then you kind of go through it? Or you have no idea?
So with the Glass Dolphin series, I knew it would be 3 books and I knew how I wanted it to end. So that one, yes, I knew how, the third book in that series, which is called Where There's a Will, I actually wrote the last chapter before I wrote the first chapter, because I knew exactly where I wanted to put my characters in their lives, right? And so, but did I know how they were going to get to that end? No, I had no idea, right? I just knew how I wanted them to end. As far as Calamity goes, I'm writing book 4 now. I don't know whether, I won't know until I finish it whether that's it for the series or whether I think there's going to be another one. And I won't know until it's done, right? Because even though it's a really well-selling series, I do find there are some authors that, maybe their series should have ended sooner than they have, right? And I don't want to be one of those authors.
And who do you mean?
we're certainly not going to name any names here. But other authors have done a remarkable job of keeping a series going for many books. And an example would have been the late Sue Grafton, who I absolutely adored and was, very sad that she didn't get to finish her alphabet series that ended at Y. But I mean, she managed to write 25 books. And if you read A is for Alibi or Y is for Yesterday, you'll see how much she grew as an author over that, those books. I mean, her plots became much more developed, even though her character only aged, I don't know, like 3 years or something in 25 books. But everything about her writing became more polished, and it really, really, really shows. So some people can do it. I don't see that I have 25 books in my Marketville series. I might have four, I might have six. I don't know. But again, if I want to do these other things, like the Stan Walls of Spanish or maybe a nonfiction, you know, something has to be put aside, right? So, and I've also published three multi-author anthologies. So Superior Shores anthologies, they're called. And, you know, that was a tremendous amount of work because I sent out the call out to the various markets and, you know, got about 100 submissions, had to call it down to like 20 stories. Then I did all the editing, the formatting, and, you know, I hired a proofreader because, you know, I wouldn't have noticed any mistake after doing all of that. And did the formatting and put it together and the cover art and all of that. So I published one 2019, 2020, and 2021. I'm taking a gap year this year. I'm not doing one this year. But I have plans to do one in 2023. That's a tremendous amount of work. But I think it's really important because I think short crime fiction, I love it. And it's how I got my start, my first publishing credit. So I try to pay it forward a little bit, right?
That's interesting. How was COVID then? I mean, we know how COVID is, but I mean, how is it for you in your writing? Do you find that it kind of makes you write darker, or perhaps maybe even it stalls your writing?
It definitely stalled my writing. 2021 was the first year that I didn't have a book out. I did get an anthology out, but I didn't have my own novel out. That's the first time since my first book came out in 2015. I had one book out a year, and it's crazy because I don't consider myself a super social person, and I spend a lot of my time by myself in my little room here writing, but I didn't realize how much I needed, you know, just to go out and have a coffee with a friend kind of thing. I didn't realize how important that was, or how much those sort of little escapes, it kept me creative, you know. And so it really has played with me for sure. I mean, health wise, touch wood, it's been good. I don't know anybody personally that's been impacted with COVID, but it's definitely, I think, harmed a lot of people's mental health for sure. Yeah. Right. And my own included, I would say. Yeah.
Oh yeah, you should see Mike's.
Yeah, I still talk myself still.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I'm grappling with now is book four in Marketville. I'm placing it's going to take place in 2022. There's like a cold case and then there's current things going on. But I'm looking at it, I'm thinking, do I mention COVID? Or do people want to, or do I just pretend it never happened? You watch TV shows, some just like Blue Bloods, takes place in New York City, no mention of COVID, nothing, not a mask in sight. And then other shows you see that they've taken it in, right? So what's the right thing? I don't know. I guess I should mention a little bit, but I keep thinking it's going to be over and it's...
No, I think it's, that's the problem. We don't know where it's going. We don't know how it ends or what happens. So I think that's kind of the question. But I think realistically, if you're writing a story happening at the time, you might not make it a major part. You might not even get into too much explanation, but you might have it there in the background around you.
That's the way I'm approaching it, is actually just sort of saying, this last year's been really tough, sort of thing, but not really going into it, not having people take masks on and off.
Yeah, bring it up like you bring up sex or nudity, right? It's only when it's needed to tell a story.
Yeah, that's the way I'm thinking of approaching it, because I honestly think that once we're out of this, and hopefully that'll be sooner rather than later, I don't think people want to revisit it. They'll just be like, enough. Like, I just don't want to hear about it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But in 20 years from now, if it does end in 2022 here, in 20 years from now, the generation then won't really have that tired experience with it like we do.
I'd be curious about the 1918 flu, about the authors back then, if they added. I know a few, one or two, but see how they responded.
Yeah.
Back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strange, because we also have different reactions. You know, we have the, you know, the maskers, and we have the anti-vaxxers, and we have all that stuff going on, and it's very public. You know, I wonder if that will affect as well, because I think all that stress gets in, right? And it's in the neighborhood. So when you're writing about today, it is there. It's in the background. You know, it's the elephant in the room, so to speak. So it's a tough one.
It absolutely is. And you know, as I said earlier, I write to talk radio, and that has been the case until this past while, because literally, I mean, on talk radio, it's all about the COVID and the numbers and this doctor's on and that doctor and this specialist and that specialist, you know, and I just think I don't want to hear about it anymore. I just don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm so grateful when somebody comes on, like earlier today on Kelly Cotrera, they had Peter Howell was on talking about, the Golden Globes, why they didn't happen or why they weren't filmed or whatever. Yeah. But it was just so great to hear something other than COVID.
You got to stay away from all that because it's overkill, you know?
Oh, it is. It is. It just gets to you after a while, you know, whatever your position is on vaccines or any vaccines, whatever. I mean, every single person out there has got to be just tired of hearing about it.
Well,
right?
Certainly, so. You know, it's just so much. Well, now, let's get into the promotion stuff. So now, how do people find you, get a hold of you? Do you have any pictures of your house that you want to put, your address up, your phone number you can put all up? Or do you have a website?
I do have a website, and I think it's quite a good website. It's judypenshelleck.com, so it should be easy to find. And I've got all kinds of cool stuff on there. I've got on my About page, I have my bio, but then I have my Enough About Me, Here's More About Me section, where this interview will be linked at some point. And I have a Facts and Fiction section where I talk about Samuel Lount or Blue Rodeo, the band that they are featured in some of my books. And so sort of the facts behind my fiction, right? So I've got some of that stuff going in there. So I think that's kind of a fun thing. I've got some recipes. Not that my stories have recipes in them. They don't. But there is mention of, say, food, and then I'll make up like a little recipe or something. So, yeah, so it's a pretty good website. And yes, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
You got to get on TikTok.
Yeah, I don't. You know, I kind of looked at TikTok and thought, I just can't do it. I just can't do it.
Well, it's been an interesting conversation. Always good to talk to authors, and we had another great one today to start the year out. So, thank you for being here, Judy Penshelleck. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nice speaking with you, Judy.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.